Hello, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Why Theory. As always, I am your host, Ryan Engley, joined, as always, by co-host Todd McGowan. Todd, how you doing, buddy?
Ryan, doing good this afternoon. How are you?
I am very well. And before we start, as you can tell from the title of the introduction, we are talking about, the title of this episode, not the title of this introduction. I am doing the introduction to this episode, so I'm getting all tripped
up. And it's
up.
About an introduction, so.
And it's about an introduction.
There's a lot of introduction in your mind.
There's a lot of introducing. I feel like we just stumbled into a Marx Brothers bit, out of nowhere. Yeah. So a lot of introducing happening up and down. I wanted to say, just a little bit of a little plug. So I have a thing, and if someone's a anyone out there, a long time listener, you'll know that this was years in the making. I have written something on sports and psychoanalysis. It has been recently published in an excellent special edition of a Psychoanalysis, Culture, and Society, edited by longtime listeners and friends of the show, Joe Reynoso. Hey, Joe, and Jack Black. Not that Jack Black, but it's my Jack Black, so hey, Jack. And it's an absolutely great issue, and so I want to put a link in the in this episode. I'm going to send to you for the whole thing. All the articles are really worth reading. Don't just read mine, please. So you'll have a link to the whole thing. I think mine is in open access. So that's a good thing for people who, I realized that way too late when I had the link to my, the bottle episode essay that probably not everybody could access.
Oh, it wasn't open access. Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't open access, but, Pomona has a deal with, I think, Springer, who publishes, PCS. So my article, I wish I had taken a look. I'm not sure how many, everybody can access, but you know what? This is the thing about academia, is if there's a title and an abstract that seems really interesting to you and you want to read it, absolutely email that person and they will send you the article.
That is a good point. No matter who you are, if you email the person, unless they're a total prick, they're going to send it to you, right?
Absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
They would have to be pretty, if they said like, no, pay the $700 for my article, then that would not be a person whose article you should want to read, I think.
Yeah. Right? You could add it to your Richard Nixon's enemies list.
I think
all of us have.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So with that introduction, nicely put out there. So I hope people do read it. It's an essay that at least I can speak for myself, my contribution. An essay I loved writing. So I hope people can tell that. We are going to talk about something I think somebody loved writing, which is Kant and Kant's introduction. He loved it so much he wrote it twice.
Right.
And we're going to talk about this will be the last solo Kant episode for a little while. We're going to take a step away from Critique of Pure Reason, as we did when we went through Phenomenology of Spirit. Although I think we're going to try to wrap this up
a little quicker.
A little quicker than we did last time.
But 7 years was probably a little too long. I don't know.
We maybe nursed that project bit. Yeah. So there's a lot to lay out here, and this is gonna. My belief is that this will pay future dividends for when we dip back into Lacan, as we're gonna do the next time that we get together. But there's a lot that's set up here. That also harkens back to some of our history of philosophy series episodes, like the Leibniz one especially, where we see where are the red lines for Kant? Like, why is he doing this? And I think, Todd, would you say is the biggest one that what Kant was seeing was this problem that he thinks metaphysics made for itself?
Right.
That it made claims that it could not substantiate, and it allowed a retort to emerge that not just cut at metaphysics itself, but that the idea that we could really know anything at all. And Kant is trying to intervene here.
Yeah, that's right. Like he really feels like, and I think we can see parallels to this in the contemporary world if we look, but he feels like when metaphysics tried to or overshot the mark and tried to make claims about what he would call transcendent phenomena. And he has three in mind: God, he says, God, freedom, and immortality, right? These questions, which are constantly preoccupied metaphysical thinkers. He's like, look, you can't, the problem is that there was this wild speculation about it, and including by Leibniz. Leibniz not only thinks that and Descartes thought he proved the existence of God. Leibniz thought he proved the existence of God. Leibniz goes further in the Theodicy and proves that there can't, that we live in the best of all possible worlds, right? And so for Kant, this would be exactly the kind of over speculating that he thinks is the problem. So he says that metaphysics has wrongly been, these are his terms, dogmatic. And then that gives rise, as you hinted at, to what he calls skepticism. So the two errors, it's like Scylla and Charybdis, are dogmatism and skepticism. And the figures you would think associated with them are Leibniz, Gottfried Leibniz on the one hand, and then David Hume on the other hand. So Kant appreciates Hume, but he also thinks Hume represents an incredible danger, because Hume basically says, look, we don't even know anything, even that causality is anything but habit, right? So he thinks all the things that we think, these laws that govern the world, Hume's like, no, those aren't really laws. We're just habituated to them, right? So this ties to his critique of induction and a belief that we can't, that we have to, that there's no secure basis for our knowledge, right? Like that's Hume's fundamental claim. And so what Kant wants to do is say, whoa, if metaphysics doesn't go so far into this dogmatism, then it will make impossible the skeptical response of Hume. And I think I it's hard not to think of, right, like contemporary right-wing response to leftist projects like this, like we're going to tolerate everything would be the leftist position, right? So you get into these things where tolerance ends up tolerating things that are just absurd or things that are contradictory, right? Like we want to tolerate the thing that actually is opposed to this other thing that we also want to tolerate. And then I think Kant would, this fits within Kant's thing, that the right-wing response is, okay, we can't know, we can have no values at all, right? We can't know anything at all about anything, right? So I think it's an interesting, you could even, I think about the rise of this late 20th century, it's called what, postmodern sophistry, I would call it, figures like Foucault and Derrida and people like that. Like, I think that they're, in a way, they're, you could say, and also they're kind of responding to a dogmatic assertions of metaphysics by claiming we can't make any metaphysical claims at all. And we can't really, our knowledge is in question. So I think that's what he's really on to in this introduction.
Yeah, no, it's a great setup, because you can see what's happening in the text and bring the thing to sort of what's happening now. And the issue that Kant is seeing is that, like, imagine that, like, there didn't have to be, okay, let's just say a left wing, a progressive, whatever the claim is, it is in some way lightly impractical, okay? That doesn't have to encourage a claim that from the right that would utterly undo it. It doesn't have to, but this is what Kant is seeing, is that we're not arguing over, like, okay, such and such is an important project or like an urgent project. What ends up getting cut out or in, like, what's the best way to do it? So we don't have, like, there's like some really good some really good critiques that I've seen of, like, the legacy of The West Wing, for example, which it's actually, I gotta say, not a show that I've seen, so I don't have a dog in this fight. I know that's probably somewhat shameful, but the someone who teaches TV, I think, should probably have seen the show. Yeah. There's this idea that, you know, like, what happens on the show and the politics is from a lot of, is that, like, everyone agrees on basically what civil rights are, and everyone agrees that, like, kind of truth exists. And so what happens politically on the show is it's sort of we just have a disagreement about how best to distribute the resources and the goods to the people. And that the political critique of that is a liberal, like, vision of the world.
Right.
Is that, like, we should just be having these, like, minute arguments about, like, how best and how technical, well, how much means testing should we do for various policy? Because we all agree that people should have welfare, when in actual fact, what the situation is that, like, no, only some people believe that all people exist. right. and deserve like yeah. respect and dignity. Like that's sort of the big, that's sort of the big issue. And so this is where you see like the warrant for what like Kant is trying to do is that like, this isn't like the reaction that, you know, metaphysics is incurring is not like, okay, well, why don't we figure out how we can actually know that God exists. What it is encouraging is this idea that we can't know anything at all.
We can't know anything at all, right?
And right. that for him is like that is way too far. And so now, because metaphysics has reached too far, as you've said, now we're in this thing where we're fighting on like on basic ideas about like what can even be known, and there must be some way of there must be some philosophy that needs to emerge here that says that we can know things, and not only can we know things, this is how we know things.
Yes.
And because to him, I think it's pretty clear, just as I imagine it is to like our listeners, that like, you know, like knowing being under assault is like what can you do with that? I mean, you used to see that in this country, and it's not exclusive to this country, but like if you assault the idea that like something can be known, then like that gives the warrant to so much regressive right. Policy.
Then everything's up for grabs, yeah. right? Everything's yeah. up for grabs yeah. after that. I think that's right, and I think it's such a good point that I think that he's really trying to save. He's trying to save knowledge. His idea is that yeah. dogmatism in metaphysics, this trying to speculate too far, ends up imperiling our faith and our ability to know the truth altogether. So I think that's, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just how he's laying it out. And his solution is really interesting. So he begins the work with the introduction, sorry, with the idea, all knowledge begins in experience, right? Or begins when experience begins. So, but then he says, but in the second paragraph, he's like, no, but all knowledge doesn't come out of experience. So you can see he's trying to play both sides of the game, right? He's trying to, on the one hand, that seems like a very empiricist beginning, but then the second paragraph is a very rationalist paragraph. So a lot of people have said Kant's just synthesizing rationalism and empiricism. I think it's maybe more helpful to think he's saying both are wrong. Both are just wrong. That, like, it's not both are right in some way. It's like both are wrong in some way, because the what neither of them sees is the way that there's a certain way that we have to, certain laws, certain rules that govern our knowing. And that if we know them, then we can engage in all kinds of empirical study, whatever. But that's understanding of that, what he calls this transcendental structure of subjectivity, is really important for Kant. And I think one of the things that can really throw people off, it threw me off when I was first reading Kant, is this distinction that he draws, and it's the words are the same in German and in French. That was a funny slip. In German and in English, so it doesn't matter. But the idea of the trans. So I said before, he's against speculation about the transcendent mm-hmm. things, right? Mm-hmm. But he believes that we can know the transcendental. So that distinction between transcendental and transcendent is really important. And what it means is the transcendent is what goes beyond sense experience. Like, does God exist or not? We don't have a sense of God, but we can speculate about it. That's mm-hmm. that's a transcendent question. The transcendental is what governs the rules that govern our sense experience, and Kant thinks those we can know, and that's what the empiricist would say. Well, no, we don't know those rules other than out of experience itself. And Hume has shown that we can't know anything out of experience itself, because experience can mm-hmm. always be changing. So I think that it's helpful to think of him as both anti-rationalist and anti-empiricist, both anti-Leibniz and anti-Hume. Like, he's not just bringing them together.
Mm. Would you say what's at stake for him? This is a genuine question. This is not a leading question that I know the answer exactly. But would you say that what he's trying to say, what he's trying to stamp out, is that we cannot know Imagine imagine like football, okay, like the NFL or whatever sport, you know, the sport that everybody calls football in the rest of the world, is just like, it's a game played by the gods, and like we don't even know how it's done or whatever. Right. It's just like something that like kind of trickles down. And what he's saying that we can't know the results of the game from our intuition that this is happening, or maybe that's the wrong word, but our intuition that this is happening, but we can understand some of the rules. Is he more on the side of rules than results, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, I think he's trying to say, right, that that whatever results, I don't think he thinks that that's even the business of what he's going to, the way that he's going to redefine metaphysics, right? Like mm-hmm. he doesn't. Like he doesn't think, because he thinks that we can't know the results, right? Like mm-hmm, he thinks right. that we can't, like we can just understand the rules that govern what we're, basically what we're allowed to speculate about and what we're not, right? Like he's mm-hmm. trying to say, look, we can, and even though you're right, it's interesting. I think it's a nice analogy, because it's not like, it is like the game has been passed down to us from the gods, right? It's just like, it's part of our subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And Kant's idea is that we can actually look at the way the game is being played and, mm-hmm. and say, look, this, in order to actually be a proper spectator of the game, I have to think that certain rules are going to apply. And if mm-hmm. I don't, and if yes. I just think, this is the idea, that if I just think that it's habit, like Hume thinks, then I can't even be a proper spectator of the game, right? Like I won't be able to conduct scientific experiments. I won't be able to perform math problems, right? Like, mm-hmm. would Hume say, like, okay, every time I perform the equation, this is Kant's example, 5 + 7. He's taking a nice, mm-hmm. easy, like, I'm not sure, I got to add it up. Is it going to be 12 or not? And Kant thinks, well, Kant, no, obviously, it's always going to be the same. And so that for him is, mathematics is very important in this introduction and plays an important role in Kant's philosophy as a model or an ideal for philosophy in a way that it is not, absolutely not for Hegel. So that's an interesting thing to talk about.
That'd be an interesting distinction to make up. Yeah, yeah.
But I do think that your point is right, that we can know those rules, and they have to be, this is his two terms, right? They have to be necessary and universal, yes. and that's how we know that they're not empirical. Right? Because nothing from experience can be either necessary or universal.
Okay. So to be clear here, so you've written a book on universality. I have a long gestating article on universality. Well, and my one sentence take has long been, the universal is the particular that changes all particulars. Now, that is not
That's not what
Kant's talking about. So just be really clear.
Yeah, because I think it's just the difference between, and I think there are three kinds of universality, right? There's a ontological universality, like are there really universals that actually exist, right? Mm-hmm. Then there's an epistemological universal, right? Like the causality is universal in the world, whatever, I'm trying to know something. Kant would mm-hmm. say that. And then there's a political universal, and I think that's what you're talking about, and that's what my book was talking about. I originally, by the way, had a discussion of all these this three forms of universality and how they all related, and the problem is that I sent the book to a friend of mine who basically hates theory and philosophy, because I wanted to get a kind of a he's very good responder, and he's like, you got to just drop all this crap. I mean, I don't know, for better or worse, it's gone. But I just focused on the political. But I think that's the difference, Ryan, right? Like that's the, you're concerned with the political universality. When Kant says universality, he just means an epistemological, conversion of knowledge, and he thinks like from experience, we can't know anything universally in that sense. We just can't. And that's Hume's critique of causality that Kant is accepting. Right.
Okay. So, here's, so then this would be my my question, just because I think it's relevant for the podcast. The universal for Kant is immanent. Yes.
Yes.
Like it's like when we cannot be
transcendent, right? That's his point. Okay. Right.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's good.
But
yeah,
it's so transcendental. So it's not. So does that qualify the immanence of it? That would be. That's an interesting question, right? Like, does it? I think he would say it's immanent, and immanent and transcendental are the same for him, right? Like it's
okay.
Because it's just like the transcendental isn't some. It's not in the sky somewhere outside of. I mean, it's outside of our sense experience, but it's like it's in a certain sense within our sense experience, although it's not a result of it, right? So. So I think that in that sense, I think immanence is a nice way to describe the Kantian transcendental. Although there, I think that the contemporary philosophers of immanence are all anti-Kantian because they're again they think that transcendental is they think that's the problem, right? That we're thinking in this transcendental term. I mean, a lot of people think it's the problem. Like for the object-oriented philosophy, like this is the Kant is the bad guy.
Yeah, he's the enemy. Yeah, right.
For exactly this transcendent, because Kant basically, I did a little research into this. Kant basically, it's not totally true, but he basically invented the term subjectivity. And right. so the fact that the transcendental is attached, like that's what subjectivity is for Kant. It's the transcendental that then governs our experience, right? And so I think people that are complete immanentists, I think they balk at that a little bit. Yeah.
And I mean this in a common sense. I don't mean this the way that he means necessity, just to be clear about setting up the terms of the question. What's the necessity of cleaving experience from immanence? Because I would think, I wouldn't use the word universal on this, but I do think that like you can see what is imminent by what remains stubborn across many different iterations of appearance. So why cleave experience from the equation of discovering the universal and the imminence of it for Kant?
It comes back to the Humean critique. Like I think he thinks if you remain wholly within experience, then you have no universality, right? Like you have no, you. So I like what you're saying about this like stubborn imminence, right? Like I think that's really good, but I think Kant's fear is that if you cede yourself totally over to experience, then you end up falling into this Humean skeptical critique. And that's this is what you started off the episode talking about, was that this is the real danger for him. That's what we have to avoid at all costs, because he thinks it imperils the project of knowledge just terribly.
So he thinks you give experience an inch and it thinks it's a ruler.
It'll take a That's really funny. Yeah, that's
Thank
good.
You.
Yeah.
You know where I got that from?
No.
That is from the pilot episode of Miami Vice.
Oh my God. That's a great. Who told that joke? Don Johnson?
No. I think it's the pilot episode. I think it's the first one. They have to go tell somebody that they have to go. I think they have to go tell Jimmy Smits's girlfriend, because he's like Don Johnson's, not his partner, but someone he's working with. And so Jimmy Smits is in the first episode until he explodes.
Yeah.
And he has to go tell his girlfriend that he died. And she, I think she has just said that, and like she works at like a diner.
Oh wow,
type thing.
Wow.
And she says that. Yeah,
that's I'm pretty great. Sure
that's pretty good.
Yeah.
It was so good that I was like, why don't people say that? Like that's
it's funny.
I'm glad I had an organic reason to say it. Anyway.
You did. You had it was totally organic.
So, but yes. So you give experience an inch, it thinks it's a ruler. That's his worry.
Okay. So that's the problem. That's why he's trying to avoid that. And that's why he wants to, that's why he makes this. Okay. So he's trying to limit, eliminate dogmatism from metaphysics in order to make metaphysics something, right? And he thinks that the way to do that, and this is, I think, the main contribution here, is to say we can actually have knowledge a priori, right? Like that's and for him, a priori means before sense experience, right? So outside of prior to a priori, before, prior to sense experience. And he thinks that we have this a priori knowledge, and it's not just, and this is, I think, the key thing, it's not just what he would call analytic, right? So it's not just knowledge that just is definitions. Like, obviously, you could say A equals A prior to, although Hegel would not say that. Hegel thinks even that isn't analytic, but that's a whole other episode, which luckily we've already done those. So, or maybe that's from the logic, I don't know. I think he would say, like, any, that, like, of course we can have those claims. Even Hume would admit A equals A prior to sense experience, no problem. But what Kant wants to say is, okay, we can even know things where there's a difference between what is being the concept and the way it's being worked out, right? And that's, so this is, for him, this is why he makes this distinction between, so he makes two distinctions, a priori, a posteriori. So prior to sense experience, as a result of sense experience. And then he makes the distinction between analytic judgments or analytic propositions and synthetic judgments or synthetic propositions. And so that's a distinction that, okay, people have kind of made it before Kant, but like this subjectivity, this is really Kant's invention, and it's pretty incredible, I think. Although it's subsequently got called into question by, like, Willard Van Orman Quine wrote a very famous article called The Two Dogmas of Empiricism, where he said, okay, I don't really buy this distinction between analytic and synthetic, really. And he tried to show why it doesn't really hold, that things that Kant thinks are analytic are really synthetic, and vice versa, that you can't sustain the distinction. But I think a lot of people, inclusive of Hegel, Schelling, and Fichte, I should say that the other way around, Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel, they thought this is pretty amazing, right? Like, they thought, wow, that distinction just clarifies so much for what we're capable of knowing and for how we think about what philosophy does, right?
Like, can I give a quick thing before you continue? So here's a quick thing. So this is from the first, this is from Introduction A.
Yeah. Which you like better, yes? You
like better. I do like a little bit better. Yeah, I think it's kind of funny. I think, you know what? My sense, we'll talk about this a little bit, but like later when, I don't often find myself the implied reader of many texts. And so this was something I had to learn through context clues to imagine. Like, I think this is absolutely crucial in reading Hegel. And I think this is a stumbling block, is that, like, he's clearly writing to a kind of reader with a set of assumptions and ideas. And he's trying to overturn those. So there's, like, you can, in the way that it's written, and I haven't read all of the one, it's Inwood, right? The one that we've started reading, or at least I started reading, and I really like.
Yeah, Michael Inwood, yeah.
So I haven't read the whole thing, and I don't know if he clears this up, or if it's just a fact of the writing, but it's definitely in the Miller where, like, you know, the sentences go on, and you kind of lose, okay, is Hegel writing to someone and to some idea, or is he writing for himself? Yeah. And it can be a little difficult, with the way that he writes. And I think that that's not unique to him. I think that that's, I think that quite often happens, even in things that are written in, today. Like, if you are, because all this stuff, like, I mean, to write, you know, to write almost anything is like, you've come into a conversation, right? A scholarly conversation that's been going on for a very long time. This is the example that, you know, I was taught to teach people in writing classes, is that, like, okay, when you do research, you are showing up to a party halfway through, And so because you're showing up at a party halfway through, there are certain people who are talking to each other for certain reasons. You don't really know why. It's not completely right. clear. You have to try to like find a way to like integrate yourself into the party. This would be, a move that I would have to fight against is like, fuck this party halfway through. I'm going to go have my own party.
Right.
So that's like more, right. more, that would be kind of more my
it's,
move, but
it's
no.
It's tempting,
but
like, right.
It's very, very tempting, but no, you just try to understand why these people are talking to each other and what they're talking about and why they're talking about what they're talking about. So that whole move, one has to have in mind when one is reading these kinds of texts, because they're written to a purpose, and the purpose is not just the creation of knowledge for knowledge's sake, which I think this was sort of implicitly, at least in like undergrad. And if I ever read any stuff like this in high school, like, I don't know, Plato or Aristotle, some real groundwork kind of things, like that is kind of the way that it was just taught to me, is like, these people are just doing this because they had the idea to do this.
Right.
And it's very distancing. So you have, anyway,
and you find that less in the first introduction.
I find that, I'll put it this way. I find it more clear who the implied reader is. Okay. Like it's easier for me in the, because it's clear to me, I mean, this is just a fact. Like he writes the other introduction as a result to, he's stealing himself from criticism.
Like, right. It's clearly a response to criticism, right? And the first one's not, right?
It's intervening in this thing that as we've set it up. Like I think like it's, there are broader questions. And so I find it more open. Like it's more of a, when I worked at Walmart, there was this, this thing, like you weren't supposed to, they didn't want you talking to your coworkers on the floor, because if a customer needed help, they would not find a way in to the conversation. I guess like one of the things that we would do is that we would just be really far away from each other, like talking, to just so that it didn't seem like we were clustered. And that was sort of our way out of it. So I kind of find the introduction A to be that sort of like, that Walmart conversation, like a, kind of like across the aisle, that like there is a space for me to enter. Whereas in the second one, I kind of feel like there's like a little bit more of a wall.
Workers kind of just chatting it up.
They've made like a little bit of a twosome. So the reason why I started talking about this was, the difference between analytic and synthetic judgments, just for anyone for whom this is either the first time or they're a little unclear about it. So this is on page 130 of the Geyer. That, are you reading out of this too?
Or
are you
the reading big Cambridge? Are you, yeah, I mean, that's the
yes,
one.
Yes, it came.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's, yeah. Okay, so he writes this. I'm not going to do the predicate because it's going to be a nightmare to hear someone to hear. Okay, so an analytic judgment is something that is covertly, and that's covertly is in parentheses, covertly contained in the concept, okay? Or lies, so okay, that's it, okay? Yeah. It's contained in the concept, analytic, okay? Synthetic is something that stands in connection with the concept. So that's the difference. In the analytic judgment, we're looking at something that is intrinsic to the concept. The synthetic is we're looking at a relation, something that is outside. And I like that. So Geyer has this, he puts this thing at the bottom of the page. There's a Kant's copy of the first edition here adds, I exist is an analytic judgment. A body exists is a synthetic one. I think that's interesting. I don't know if that clears things up, but that would be the thing. So the analytic judgment, we're looking at something that is intrinsic to the concept, and then a synthetic one is we're looking at a relation, something that's a little bit outside the concept, but is related to it.
Yeah, I mean, so his example is I think it would strike a contemporary thinker or person. Sorry, thinker seems weirdly abstruse. A contemporary reader or person as a little bit odd, right? Like one of his examples is extension. Like if you say a body is extended, that's an analytic judgment, right? This is analytic. Like that extension is somehow included in the concept of a body. But then if you say a body weighs something, then that's synthetic. right? So, so I think a lot of us would say, like, well, wait a minute. Why does extension get this priority? This comes back to your conversation reader question, right? Like, why does extension get this priority and not wait? Like, doesn't a body have to wait? It can't be zero, right? It like isn't the very concept of a body doesn't include weight. And I think it's actually he's intervening in this whole primary secondary qualities debate, right? Like that extension is thought of as absolutely primary to something, whereas weight, color, these are secondary qualities. So I think that's why he chooses that example, but I don't think it's a felicitous example actually to help us. Like, I think that because I think the distinction is kind of lost on the modern reader, I think, between those two things. I mean, color might be better, right? Like, if you said a body has extension, because how could you think of a body without extension, right? Like, that's his point. But a body has a color. Sure. Well, we can think it's not, I guess it's, can you think of a body without color? It depends on what you think of as colorlessness, right? Like, like, is it black and white film? Does it not have color, or does it have black and white or the colors, right? Like,
yeah,
it's a whole question. So I don't know. I mean, I think that would be a better, color would have been a better, he does mention color, but I think it would have been a better main example for that idea. Or just like, I think that there are other, it's funny how he does talk a little bit about A equals A, but I would think that would be I guess he's trying to make, because no one really, I guess the law of identity, or the two things I thought he would maybe make more of are the law of identity, so A equals A, and then the principle of non-contradiction, that's an analytic truth for him, right? Like, it's not synthetic, because...
That's a big thing. That's a change, though, between A and B, is identity comes into the equation for him. So that's that's probably why you're thinking that. Like, that same section is rewritten to say, where is it? Yes, he says this. Okay. Analytic judgments, in parentheses, affirmative ones, are thus those in which the connection of the predicate is thought through identity. But those in which this connection is thought without identity are to be called synthetic judgments.
Yeah.
And I find that a little less clear.
You find it less clear. Right. Interesting. Yeah.
I find it a little. Yeah.
Then like then saying that the predicate is contained within the concept, like that.
Yeah.
That makes more sense.
That's easier for me, whatever reason it is.
Yeah. No.
I guess maybe you could clear this up. I don't know what he means by identity.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think he's. I think he's referencing the law of identity there. So he's referencing a whole. So
it's that party conversation.
The party conversation.
I was
eating
on the first conversation, and then I left, and he came back, and he had another one. Going on.
Yeah. I think that those two laws, the law of identity, and the law of principle of non-contradiction, I think that's what he's referencing. And so, if it's just an expression of identity, he thinks it's analytic. And if it's an expression of something that goes beyond identity, then it's like, if I say, I mean, this is a classic example from Bertrand Russell. So he says, Scott is the, what's Scott's first name? I'm just totally blank. Scott is the writer of Waverly, right? Waverly is a novel Sir Walter Scott. I just remembered. George C. Scott, sadly. Maybe it would have been better. So for Russell, that's just a statement of identity, right? Like Russell differentiates between statements of identity and statements of predication. This is part of his whole critique of Hegel, that Hegel confuses identity and predication. But that's completely beside the point. But you see, Walter Scott and author of Waverly are exactly the same person, right? Like, you're not adding anything
right.
to that. So it's just a pure statement of it. So it's an analytic truth. And I think that for Kant, like, those kinds of truths are just abundant, right? Like, they're just, there is an infinite number of them, just like there's an infinite number of a posteriori, I can't say it, a posteriori.
It's a tough one.
It is
a
posteriori synthetic truths, right? Like there's like, I just saw a bird fly across the sky. The birds can fly across the sky, right? Like that's my how many judgments does like that do we make every day based on experience? Yep. We'd make a ton of them, right? Like I think Kant gives an example of like the building is heavy, right? Or something. The building has a foundation.
Right.
The building has a foundation. Like it's a, you have to rely on your experience. And so, but you can make a judgment about it. So I think that's why for him, and then of course the one kind that is completely impossible to even imagine would be an analytic a posteriori judgment, right? Like what could that be?
Right.
Like it's analytic, but it happens after experience, which that can't after. Be, it can't be analytic, right?
So okay. That's a clear line.
Like there's a four boxes, right? And like one box has an X in it because you could never have that. The other two of the boxes are common. They happen all the time. Everybody accepts them. And then Kant's intervention is this fourth box, right? Like the synthetic a priori judgment or proposition. And he wants to say, yeah, we can do that. And I think that that's really, so dividing it up in the way he does is the great innovation. And then the solution is just incredible. And it's interesting that it was so influential. I mean, it basically shapes German idealism after that. And then, you could even say that up until the present, people are either wrestling with this, accepting it, or trying to basing their whole philosophy on the rejection of it. Like, I think that, again, that's what Graham Harman and object-oriented ontology, that's their whole thing. We're going to reject this, like saying that every claim we make has to take place within this. Like those are the real philosophical claims, or these synthetic a priori judgments, and they want to say no, our knowledge isn't limited like that.
Mm. You know who loves extension? It's Sigmund Freud. He loves the idea of extension. No, and I'm not making a joke.
You're not making a joke. I thought you were making some kind of phallic
a penis
joke.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm happy to have that read into my thing, but no, he actually there's this. So as we've mentioned before, and this maybe throws a grenade into the discussion that doesn't need to be there because it's hard to read this stuff and make sense of it. But there's this part of the standard edition that no one reads except for Joan Kopchak, and it's called Shorter Writings. It's at the absolute end. It's like there's a line in the Simpsons episode where Homer is trying to convince his children that gambling is morally okay in the Bible. It actually says that you can gamble. They're like, where does it say that? And he's like, it's somewhere in the back. This is literally somewhere in the back of the standard edition. This is like all the way at the end. And it's just a note. And Freud writes this. Space may be the projection of the extension of the psychical apparatus. No other derivation is probable. Instead of Kant's a priori determinants of our psychical apparatus, psyche is extended, semicolon, knows nothing about it. It's just a really beguiling thing. I write something very, very brief about this in my book manuscript, but it's for Freud, just because we're doing this, and we're trying to make the unlikely perhaps connection to psychoanalysis. It's in this, I suppose, this abandoned, because he goes back to talk. He goes to talking about identity in the second the revision in the introduction B. So, but it's clear Freud likes, like I do. So that's a good validation. It makes me feel good about myself. It's clear he likes the introduction A.
Yeah,
and for him, it's not all bodies are extended, but I don't know if we would say all psyches are extended, but like the psyche is extended. That would be, if you wanted to argue Freud as a Kantian, like I think that's where you would start.
Right.
Is for Freud, psyche is extended. And what he means by that, I think you more have to play out the consequence in the form of what he writes than in anything he literally says, because it's just like the Kant references aren't directly there. He writes this toward the end of his life.
Well,
and if he had lived longer, maybe he would have put it in there.
Most of his Kant references are to Kantian morality, not to Not to this. Not to the theoretical philosophy, right? Like I,
which
yeah,
makes
I
this a very interesting.
I think in a way that's also a reference to the transcendental aesthetic, where Kant says that we have to, our intuitions are only spatio-temporal, right? They have to occur in space and time, and I wonder if that's like Freud trying to intervene in that. Like trying to say like, oh, it's not that our into, yeah, I think he's, you know, he had this ambition to be a philosopher. And I think he's trying to say like, there's something like we can take Kant's notion of the body extended or about like our, the necessary spatiality of our intuitions and then translate that into the way the psyche comports itself, right? Like, I think that's what he must be trying to do. It's like, it's so enigmatic though, that it's hard to,
hard to really know
what to do with it.
Maybe we'll come back to it sometime. Our friend Danny Cho, hey Danny, had a suggestion for us to do a series of episodes called like gnomic propositions or I don't know, maybe like half axes or just like these things that like philosophers or like, they just say like the one time.
Yeah.
And then that's it. And it's
it's a cool idea. It's fascinating idea, right?
And I mean, it's a fascinating idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what's interesting about this beginning is that it's the introduction is really the opposite of that, right? Like it's this thing that not only does Kant himself come back to again and again, but everybody after Kant does. The extent of the breakthrough, because what it does is it allows Kant to solve the problem of, he basically thinks like, I can solve the problem of knowledge by limiting knowledge, right? By saying, look, our knowledge is just limited to this. And so it means we can't speculate about certain questions, but it means we can know truth. We can have the truth about certain things. And if they don't, his idea was, look, if they don't follow, like I kept thinking as I'm reading this time, I kept thinking about Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon, right? And so,
Oh, nice.
You know, which is this, if people don't know it, it's a great film and it's about these different, it's the same event, which not coincidentally, I think, is the rape of a woman by a bandit. And we get these different accounts of the rape and then the film never really, I mean, it now is entered into our vocabulary, a Rashomon like thing that where we don't know, we have different accounts and there's never a definitive answer. I think that there's somewhat of a definitive answer in Rashomon, but it's still not utterly clear. And it causes what's interesting is it causes this incredible crisis of, I don't know, would you say crisis of faith or crisis of knowledge by the two protagonists? They're kind of appalled by just this, not the event so much as the conflicting accounts of it. Right. And I think,
but isn't it the thing in the film though? I feel like this is, and every time I've ever seen anything that's like, oh, Rashomon effect, Rashomon, that the conclusion is it's like a distinctly Humean one where it's like, well, you just really can't know anything. And I think that this, what's really distinct about the film is that I do think it's like, okay, maybe we can say like, I mean, there are some common things that are across all the accounts.
Right.
So certainly there's certainly like lower T truth investigation that we can do there. But because there's an abandoned child, there's like an orphan child that they become aware of like at the end of the movie. And it's like, there is this, the bigger T truth is actually what matters. It's like, we can quibble over like what might have happened, but while we do that, we ignore duty, or we ignore this larger thing. And I think maybe that, I mean, maybe this, it's like a perfect example, because then that gets into perhaps like a Kantian morality,
Kantian ethics, right? At the same time, right. Like it's as if this Humean problem leads us not just into a epistemological nightmare, but into a moral one as well.
Right.
Like that's kind of what I really, Ryan, that's a great reading of the film. I think
thank you.
It's really, it's really great. I think that's exactly right. I hadn't even ever thought of that connection between those two things. But I do think that the film in other ways allows you to make certain deductions, but finally you're right. Like, we don't know. And I think Kant feels like we're like, and I think that that like in a way Kant's responding to a Rashomon situation, but not about a particular event, but about something that's beyond sense experience, right? Like yeah. we're having this Rashomon effect with questions about God and questions about immortality and questions about freedom. And Kant says, look, we need to stop that. And I think he thinks that if we understand the rules that govern every claim that is made and everything that happens within what he calls the field of possible experience, then we can then we can make sure that we're not going to be misled, because we know there'll always be causality. We know there'll always be, he has these 12 categories, which we'll get to later. Although he seems to be very fetishistically attached to causality, right? Like it's his bread. It's in fact his only example. So there are 12 categories, but the only example he ever gives is causality. I guess because it's Hume is called causality into question, and so that's the one.
He wants to really nail that down.
Yeah, I guess. Do you think that's why it is, or it's weird I though, kind of, isn't it?
Well, I think it has to be. I mean, I think it gets. I think it gets back to the implied reader. I think you've said this to me before too, that when you write something, I know that you do this, when you write anything that you write, you imagine the person on the other end is just the least sympathetic, just the biggest asshole that could possibly be reading your thing. And you write in a way that what is going to be that asshole's problem with what I'm doing here? And you try to mitigate it that way. Yeah. And I think he's done the same thing, which is I'm not writing to a sympathetic reader. I'm not writing to an adherent. Because there's no way that person didn't exist when he begins writing it. So how could he write to that person?
For sure.
So I think that's exactly why those are the examples. He's like, I'm writing the people who are going
to I'm writing to David Hume, in effect.
I'm writing to David Hume. Yeah, and Humeans. These are going to be the people who are going to be the people who are going to find the value in this work, because they're going to think of it as a scandal. And from the end as a reader, he's writing to the people who need the most convincing, but also because they need the most convincing, they see the value. They would in perhaps in a negative way, or in a way that they're trying to seek to, like they would yell at him at the party, or they'd seek to throw him out or whatever. Yeah. But in that gesture, see the value in what he's doing. That would be my reading.
No, I like that a lot. I think that he's trying to. I think that has to be why causality plays just this crucial role for him. And it also is the category that makes the most, it seems like it's the one most in question and the one we most commonly deal with, right? Like most of our questions are about scientific proofs or whatever. Like it's usually a question of like, where is the causality here, right? Can we make the causal link? And I think he thinks that that's where the greatest danger lies too. Like if we lose causality, then we lose truth altogether. I think that's his. And if our way of thinking about history takes our knowledge of causality out of things, if we just say, well, that happened after that, but God only knows if it was the cause, right? Then we lose any truth claim that we could make out of a historical event, right? So I think that that's, for him, there's just an incredible danger in losing causality, which is why he comes back to it again and again. But I think you're right that it's the Hume, like that's his imagined reader, that's the audience, that's the, he wants to be convincing. He wants to say, okay, if you're a Humean, of course you're not going to agree with me, but at least you're not going to have that, I'm going to have at least tackled you head on, right? Like I haven't shied away from the fight.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no moment where it's like, well, what if we did this other thing that doesn't directly contend with the core of the Humean project? Like it's just, he's cutting at it directly. I know if I draw a walk in this situation with the bases loaded, it'll get the run in and that'll tie the game, but I'm not going to take that. I want to hit the ball.
Right.
And I want to take my chances that it's gonna win the game. You know, that kind of thing.
Right. And it did win the game. So it's impressive true, for yeah. that reason, right? Like it really, I mean, it made Kant, this book alone made Kant the modern philosopher, I think more than Descartes and more than anybody after him. So I think it really, I think that was advisable that he focused on causality in the way that he did. And he does it throughout. He never varies. It's always causality. That's the focus. And I think I just think people were so impressed by this idea, and I'm impressed by it, that you can make connections without relying on experience. And that's really what philosophical knowledge is, right? Like that's, isn't that basically what he's saying? And I think you can see the influence on Hegel and dialectical thinking is incredible. Even though the part of the book that Kant calls the transcendental dialectic is only dialectic in a negative sense. It's only, he thinks dialectic is bad. But Hegel thought that the synthetic a priori judgment was an evidence of dialectical thinking on Kant's part. So he himself was really impressed. As I said, as was everybody, I think, in the way. I mean, it made Kant the most famous philosopher in the world in a matter of a few years. So it's a nice, he got to enjoy his dotage a little bit, right? He never had to leave Königsberg. Like people just came to see him. In Königsberg's little town, no one wanted to come there. They just came to see Kant, you know?
That's pretty good. Kantensberg, I can't make it work, but you understand where I'm getting at.
Yeah, I do.
I mean, you can tell too, like the when someone has like the intervention, capital T, capital I, it's like, you know, people are content. Like Hegel isn't contending with Hume anymore.
Right.
He's contending with Kant, you know, like, right. like this is, we haven't, I mean, and this would be to put it in Hegelian terms is that like the revelation for is the revelation that Kant's intervention herald is that it completely changes the philosophical antagonism. So now we're not talking about this metaphysics v. skepticism conversation at all. We're like dealing with has Kant figured it out? Is there everything here, or is there something else, or is there some
right? I mean, the problem will become like he'll generate his own problem, right? And his own problem is he thinks all we can know, and this he'll get to, he doesn't really talk about this here. All we can know is the realm of experience, right? And the realm, which is a realm of appearances. And beyond the appearance is the thing in itself. We can't know anything about that. And that distinction will be a real problem. We talked about this in the preface episode that the difference between we can think something and we can have a cognition about it, but that would not be satisfying for any of for Fichte, Schellinger, Hegel. They would all say like this thing in itself, it's like, they would call it something like the bugbear, although there's a German word for bugbear that I don't know. They would call it the bugbear of Kantian philosophy and then they'd try to solve that problem, right? But the point, your point is exactly right. The problem changed. The problem is no longer this dogmatism skepticism problem. And in fact, in a number of years, all of a sudden, you could still be a Humean. This is kind of interesting, I think. You could still be a Humean, even Wittgenstein, you could say, late Wittgenstein, you could say kind of is a Humean, a little bit of a Humean, right? But you couldn't be a Leibnizian. It just, all of a sudden, that just was off the table. So that's a pretty, I just feel like that as an intervention is pretty impressive. Like it just, all of a sudden, a whole line of thinking and philosophy it's no longer, it ceases to be viable.
And you mean for, like, not that no one read or found value in Leibniz, but just as far as like what was the relevant and like urgent philosophical question?
Right.
Like
exactly,
Leibniz
exactly.
Had so, exited the party.
Right. Yeah. In the 19th century, as a philosopher, you couldn't proclaim like, I'm a Leibnizian and people would take you seriously. That's what I mean. Mm-hmm. Like, of course, yeah, you're right. Like, people still found value in him. People still read him, of course. But this Kantian critique of dogmatism, it held, I think. It really, I mean, it's an interesting thing that the critique of skepticism didn't have as much sway, right? Like, that's funny to me because I find it a pretty good critique of skepticism as well. And I just think people can't resist the skeptical temptation, right? Like, it's just, there's just something about it that's, because it's, well, for one thing, it's always easier than dogmatic speculation, right? It's, and
yeah.
And it, and,
well,
and,
I mean, it's, you, I thought you can't you get, sorry, but
no, go ahead.
Isn't, I mean, I think like the position of the contrarian, right?
It's like, exactly. Like that, I thought like, you were going to say that. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 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 It's just so like, it's so tempting. I mean, it's also, you can tell how tempting it is to like, to be a contrarian, because if you accuse a contrarian of being a contrarian, they'll tell you they're not.
That's exactly
like,
true.
That's
yeah. 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 It's a great point, right? And the link back to Freud is like, that person is a pervert, right? Like it is the,
yeah, yeah.
Or a hysteric, right? It could be this hysterical act. I think it depends probably. But that, those positions are so psychically appealing that I think that's probably never, we're probably never going to be done with skepticism, even though, even despite Kant's, I think, pretty good refutation of it. I think we should not leave.
So that's, no, hold
yeah,
on.
Go,
that's
go,
interesting.
Go, go, go. Yeah.
I want to, that's interesting. Like that's, if Freud was able or lived long enough to like tease out what precisely it was, that intervention that we just have that note, you know, yeah. I wonder if that, if what he would have written, I mean, I suppose there's a really good book to be written here about like the, like linking the psychical appeal, not the logical appeal, but the psychical appeal of skepticism and bringing that into the psychoanalytic fold and just sort of explaining on the value of the like appeal to the psyche, why this persists despite like evidence to the contrary, which it like is one of the like, I mean, isn't that like one of the, like the dominant questions, like political questions or like things that pop up on the internet? Like why does, you know,
why do people believe this despite all the evidence that it's not true?
Right. Like the QAnon person, like I, unless this person was making it up, I swear I read this, that the person who started it revealed himself and was like, yeah, this is not a thing. Like I was messing with people. And then of course, I mean, this is just always how it works, is like, that doesn't matter. That just continues. It doesn't matter how ridiculous it is.
Right.
And it's the, like, I mean, just like the vaccines cause autism. Like that guy, he made it up.
And then, you know, I have a relative who believes this theory adamantly, ardently. And then that study came out where it was like, okay, there's absolutely no connection. And then the person was like, well, what do you think they're going to
say? Yeah, exactly.
There's no refuting, right? And I think you're right. Like, it's interesting because I think there has, like Slavoj, other people have talked about the psychic role of cynicism. You've done this a little bit. But not of skepticism, right? Like there hasn't really been this real engagement. And I think you're right. Freud would have found that interesting. And it does, like, it so nicely overlaps with the Kantian project. And I think there's a lot of synergy, right, between German idealism and psychoanalysis, for sure. That's the whole thing we talk about all the time.
Yeah, I know all the time. Yeah.
But I think this is one of the areas where you haven't seen that much thought go into, because I guess, I don't know, I'm not sure why, because it is, there is a real sense of the danger of skepticism. I think that, I mean, just like you're saying, more than ever, right? Like more than even in Kant's time, right? Because people are like, what the hell? We're going to, like, the skepticism really allows people to what do they say? Like vote against their interests, which I think is
sure.
What is everyone? My question always like, when has anyone ever voted for their interests? But okay, that's
Or the other way to put it is what, like voting against someone's interests, they're telling you what their interest is.
Yeah, like, although I think it depends on how you define interest, right? Like that's a
our way, which is like the enjoyment kind of thing.
Don't
you think like the first part of this project? I think would be that like, okay, there is a I don't know. I mean, maybe you think otherwise, but like I certainly think there's like the. Well, I don't know, actually. Now I'm saying this, now I'm beginning this sentence out loud, I'm going to have to think more about it. But I think I'll say in a general way, the first part of this project would have to be that, like, okay, how much of this would be Hume's thing, were he still alive? Like, where is the line on that? Like, if there's a progression of of position from like a hermeneutics of suspicion, which obviously, you know, you and I were on that side. Yeah. Where's that? Where's the line to skepticism? And then the line to the other of the other, as we've talked about with like conspiracy and whatnot.
Right.
So like where does that, where and when does that progression?
Well, take, that, right. Take That's, place? You're right. That's a nice way to define the project, right? You have even have all the chapters laid out for the person. Whoever
all
right,
so I just made
up.
Work for myself. I'll just have to write that down. Yeah. So there we go. Good for me.
Yeah. No, I really like that. I think you're right. Like because it seems like the political dimension people are pretty aware of, but then they don't. That's never connected today. I mean, I think Kant is trying to connect it in this introduction, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's because he thinks of it as a catastrophe. And I think why? Because he sees what would happen. And I think the philosophical dimension, though, is, I think, not explored. It's just the political. Mm-hmm. And then the psychic dimension is not explored, except in this very rudimentary way, like why do people vote against their interests? Like these stupid questions like that. So I think it seems to me like that's a real exigent kind of project, right? And very much in keeping with Kant's project in the introduction and in the whole book, where he's trying to really make an intervention in this looming catastrophe that he sees at work, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's just incredible. Let's just talk about, before we stop, I want to talk about mathematics because it has such an important role for Kant in the introduction that his favorite what's Kant's favorite mathematical equation? 5 + 7 equals 12.
Right? Yeah.
He repeats that again and again. So I mean,
it's an interesting choice, isn't it? Just to make like a dumb comment. It's like he could have done 6 + 6. You know,
he could. Yeah, I think he didn't want to do 6 + 6 because I think
there's
a kind of identity problem with 6 + 6.
Yeah,
right? He does not want, and I think this is an interesting claim that he thinks that mathematical judgments are not analytic. Right. And I think if we think of, like, it's an odd thing I think it's hard for us to deal with that because if you think of, say, just the way these terms are used today, analytic philosophy versus continental philosophy, well, analytic philosophy is more modeled on mathematics, whereas continental philosophy isn't. So I think our tendency is to think, wait a minute, no, mathematics is analytical. But he thinks that 5 + 7. That the sum is somehow not in that concept, right? Like, or that's the subject. The predicate is the sum is not in that, right? The predicate is not in that. And I think, I don't know. It's interesting because Hegel would have almost the exact opposite position. Like, he doesn't really believe is anything as analytic as we've said. But but if anything is, it's close. It's mathematics, right? Like, that's his critique of mathematics. It's not. It can't be dialectical. So
I told you this before we started. This was the one moment when I exactly was the implied reader. Like I felt exactly the target. Yeah. Because I thought for sure. Because
you're like, mathematics is analytic, buddy.
For sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I thought like that was, so I felt spoken to by Kant on this. And I see what he means. Like to go back to the use of the word, like result, like the result, it is, I guess it's like, you got to kind of bend the way that you think about it, but like the result isn't inhered in the numbers.
Right.
I
like that. I think that's pretty good. Yeah. And I think that what he's really getting at is the way that, we're already doing, and this is why mathematics is so important for him, right? Because we're already doing this thing. Mm-hmm. And so it has to be true that there are synthetic a priori truths because, we're already doing this thing where we're finding them. Right. And no one doubts it. No one's like, and this is like, comes back to the thing. No one goes 5 + 7. I don't know. Let's count it out. let's experience it. I'm not sure.
That's true.
Right.
Let's experience the counting. Then we can know when we get
to
the
end. Never do that. And so this is how Kant proves everything. And it's, I think it's pretty ingenious, right? Like he proves that, like, how do we prove something that something's possible? Well, what are we doing now? That's possible. Mm-hmm. Right? Like that's how we prove it. So his proof of our synthetic a priori truths possible, well, we already have them. So we know.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that that's pretty, and certain laws of physics too, right? Like gravitation or magnetism or whatever. Like these laws that don't require us to experience for us to know that it's true. Although physics is interesting, a little more interesting than math, right? Like, because certain developments in theoretical physics of the 20th century, I think, like what Kant would say is a priori true, I think would come into question, right? Just for instance, that like space and time are constant everywhere, right? Like that's just not true. That is not true, right? Like that's just like, and it's not only not true for things in themselves, which Kant didn't think it mattered. It's not true even in our experience, right? Like we can experience things as they become proximate to a black hole as space and time changes there, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So I think that
the black hole throws a, like the black hole puts a black hole in those kinds of assumptions. Yeah.
And just that, I mean, I think that, don't you think that there was a whole, like so much of the way Kant thinks depends upon the existence of simultaneity and doesn't, and after Einstein, I think we know that nothing occurs simultaneously, right? Like, I mean, the difference between what's happening here and what's in Vermont, I'm in Vermont, you're in California. Like it's like a nanosecond difference, right? But there's still like, we're not, what seems to us simultaneous is not simultaneous. And I think that kind of ruins the universality part of Kant's whole claim here, right? Like there are people that think that Kant is the philosopher of Newtonian physics and not—
Interesting.
And that the 20th century sort of invalidates him. If you would claim that, I think you would say then Hegel is the philosopher of 20th century, right? Like quantum mechanics, right, et cetera, I think.
Right. Which is what Slavoj has actually—
Yeah, Slavoj, of course, is the great thinker of this. I mean, he's the one close— unfortunately, we have nobody on the other side who's been converted to Hegel and can write that definitive book. So the closest we get is Slavoj, who's read, 50 probably books of physics by people trying to popularize it. And, I think he's done a pretty great job, but
it's just so hard.
It's so hard. It's impossible, right? It's impossible. And I think I almost think it's impossible the other way too. I think Hegel is hard enough that unless you really are committing your, this may be going too far, committing your life to understanding him, you're not going to be able to write that book, to write one book on Hegel, it took me 10 years of like just poring over the text. And, I don't think you could do it just as a, I don't know what, interloper or whatever.
Yeah. So, that's hard. So like
a book that'll never be written, I think.
Well, but it's hard, but see, so this would be, I guess the problem is, and this is not unjustified, but like people who really know physics, I know, like this is what you're saying. People who really know physics, they read Zizek and they're like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right.
And it's like to that extent, of course he doesn't, because you really know physics. And that's the hard thing. So I think, I don't know. I just wonder if there's space in just the opening. Is that possible? Just the opening.
Yeah. The problem is though, Ryan, like I agree. Yeah. I agree. And yes, but like I read like even dedicated people that dedicate themselves to understanding Hegel, three-quarters of them have no idea what's going on. I mean, sorry, that sounds arrogant, but I mean, sorry. So how in the world is someone who's a physicist gonna, as a part-time thing, I just don't see how it could happen. right? So, yeah, no, so that's what I'm saying. The other way doesn't work either.
It kind of sounds silly both ways. I'm a physicist, but a part-time Hegelian. Or it's like, yeah. I'm a Hegelian, but a part-time physicist.
Yeah, you're just kidding. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Slavoj, it's a great effort, right? And he's probably right about a lot of things, but you're right. Like I heard him have a conversation with the physicist. And the physicist was like, you're pretty good on this, but you're still never going to get the intricacies and nuances and theoretical niceties. You're just never going to get that.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I think that there is that claim about Kant, that he's just a Newtonian ultimately. And when Newtonian physics falls, Kant falls. And I don't know. I mean, I don't think that, but I can see that point. I think it's just because of the way like universal laws governing our forms of possible experience, like that, I don't know. That seems like you need some idea of simultaneity and universality of space, right? And I think that that's not, and I think Hegel doesn't need that. Right? He doesn't. In fact, he understands why that doesn't exist.
And so, the unwritten Freudian project might not have needed that either.
Right. I don't think it would have. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Mm. So there we go.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Tom McGowan. What's the lesson?
I think the lesson is, since we only talked about one film, I think the lesson has to be watch Rashomon. We need to have more. Mm-hmm. And the other lesson for us is we need to have more Kurosawa lessons, because Rashomon is not even a great Kurosawa film. I mean, he's got like...
Well, I don't know about that. I take exception.
Here's be my point.
You're good.
I don't think Rashomon is a top 10 Kurosawa film.
I think that's a qualified because he's so great.
Well, right. Okay. Fair enough.
I think I could
do it right off the top. I'm not going to do it, but I'm going to do it right off the top of my head.
Do five. Do the top five.
Okay. So... For me, High and Low is one. Ikuru is two. You got to probably put Seven Samurai.
I think so.
Yojimbo, and then Drunken Angel, maybe? I don't know. One of those.
Nice.
I'll not keep going.
No, it's a good five. Keep it at five. Top five is good.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not Rashomon, sorry. It's not in there. I don't think.
I'm sorry. Right? Rashomon.
I know.
Maybe there's another episode where there's a different take on where Rashomon places.
Maybe. You'll come up with a definitive reading of Rashomon. Although your reading of it made me like it more, I have to say. So,
thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that was a great reading that will unfortunately never be published because.
Well, this is published.
You have too many. You know the French saying for this? You have too many cats to whip.
That is really okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's an anti-cat comment, so I don't appreciate that, but I do understand the sentiment.
It is very funny though. J'ai d'autres chats à fouetter. But it's like I have other fish to fry, which is not very nice to fish actually.
That's anti-fish. It's a good point. Yeah. It's but like, have you ever heard this one? I like this. It's don't beat a dead horse, which is anti-horse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't feed a fed horse. I've heard that.
Oh,
I like that.
Kind of nicer.
It's kind of nicer.
Yeah,
nice,
that's the liberal version of don't beat a
There's
dead
a liberal version. Yeah, right.
All right, Ryan. Over and out, man.
Over and out, Todd.